Welcome to Screen Tone Club. We are recording on the 7th of March 2021 for release on the 16th of March 2021. Oh yeah, we're recording a week ahead of time. Sorry, I'm getting confused at my own notes. My name is Elliot Page, perpetually perplexed, and I am joined as always by my lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm very good. I'm going to apologise in advance if anybody hears any fireworks during this podcast, but Glasgow Rangers have just won their first league title in a decade, and people are kind of, well, some people in Glasgow kind of excited, some people very much less so.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think there's been lots and lots of stickers for both sides posted around all the various road signs down here. So I haven't got a clue, but hey, have fun, I guess. Just be careful. Don't put fireworks anywhere near anything explosive.
Yeah. It's always the crazy thing, living in a city with a massive football rivalry, and trying to be on the sidelines of that, where everybody feels like you have to have a side. It's like, no, I'm a typical third party football fan that just wants to make fun of whoever's losing at any given point in time. So please just let me have my fun in peace.
I mean, if you mentioned you're an Arsenal fan, how what would that end up with? Would you be in a ditch?
Like, no, I mean, it's mostly just sympathy, to be honest. So no, it's all fine.
The global default for Arsenal fans is well, yeah, bless you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Damn, oh dear. We've got a local football team here, but unsurprisingly, the whole thing's off for the moment because of the Roni, which is a shame because I really like the football stand, which sounds like the nerdiest thing in the world, because it is, because I like the brutalist structure of it. Because, again, nerd, so sue me. Also, it's dead cheap to go and hang out there, so whatever. But not right now. But anyway, soon, hopefully. We'll see. Anyway, this is not about football, unsurprisingly, although we might cover football manga at some point. I know I keep threatening Andy with it at some point. This is about, well, manga, Japanese comics, yada yada, Japtoons, whatever. And yeah, we do this every fortnight. I hope you enjoy it. We also do a bonus episode every month, which people vote on our Patreon. We recently put up an episode about Batoum, the Battle Royale-inspired video game-based kind of survival game, World's Most Dangerous Game manga, which was prescient in some weird way, at least in terms of cultural output. So go have a listen to that if you want to chip in a dollar or more per month on our Patreon. And also on the Patreon bent is Mr. Rob Jessup, who very kindly supports us at the shoutouts tier. So here is your shoutout, Rob. Thank you once again, as always. So first and foremost in this, before we get to our main topics, our returning champions, where we talk about series we talked about previously on the podcast once more, because, well, you know, the name. Do you mind if I take first stab, Andy?
No, go for it.
So I've gone back to a pair of things that we've talked about in premium podcast, premium Patreon-only episodes. So I'm going to keep things a bit short so I don't give away all the juicy Patreon content. First and foremost is Batoum, which was the most recent Patreon bonus episode. And I picked up Volume 2, even though we had previously talked about not really wanting to carry on due to the length and some of the more skeevy elements of Volume 1. And all I can really say is, yeah, it does everything we feared. Maybe not quite everything yet, but it's already introduced like a hyper edgy 14-year-old rapist murderer who kills his own shit deadbeat dad and is just like ow the edge, and like, I don't know, like something about his face makes him look like he's had his head flattened on and he's having a few problems. And then of course the main character, even though knowing that he is like a complete and utter irredeemable psychopath, spares him for some reason, and now they're both in this weird like, oh, my rival, oh, we're both great at their video game, and now we're on the island where their video game is real. And also like a 20-page tutorial on the whole like radar ping mechanic, which it goes over several times. Also, it starts to introduce the main female character, who still looks like a sex doll. In fact, even more so, there is like you barely see her until the last chapter, and you know, it's like the opposite of Manic Pixie Dream Girl. It's like Damaged Goods Dream Girl, where it's like, oh no, she's had the worst backstory, I will fix her through sex. And it's like, okay, fuck off. And of course, like the next volume preview for Volume 3 is rapey as hell. And yeah, more shame on me for picking up Volume 2 and taking a look, but I had to know, and I'm definitely Double Dutch not going to carry on now, because it likes to give time to the most irredeemable of characters, and at the same time kind of sometimes cuts off the more interesting elements of the whole world state. So yeah, I'm kind of done. As I say, it's kind of devolved, it's kind of dived in, it's gone all in on the bad bits that I worried it would. So there's Batum.
Yeah, so that it's clearly my vague kind of recollections of the first few episodes of the anime adaptation not entirely off base then, as it turns out.
Also, it tries to make the main character sympathetic in multiple ways, but all it does is make me hate him even more, because he does not deserve one whit. And if anything, after this volume, he's even more of a scumbag, because it just tosses off stuff that is kind of like highly, highly irredeemable. And I don't want to mention it because it'll be a long explanation, but like, yeah, no, like this main character should not be lionized or let off the hook in any way. And it's now at least twice it's tried to pull this trick, and no, I'm done. Like, no, this character sucks. Like, he can go away. Like, maybe we should just change the main character to the like overweight Osakan property developer, even though property developer means he's bad. But you know, you get the idea.
Yeah. At least, well.
Yeah. So shame about that, but that's been Batum. And finally, I have my final returning champion is Starcrossed, which we talked about in another previous premium episode, and I read through the remaining three volumes 2, 3, or 4. And I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow of everything. I must admit, this has kind of turned out to be a disappointment, because it seems, and this is not going off of any real research, but it seems like it was under the axe from about halfway through volume 3 to the end. Like, it keeps introducing more and more elements. Like, volume 2 ends on kind of a bit of a banger in terms of, oh shit, see what happens next week on Starcrossed. Like, actual kind of interesting thing that it then kind of sidesteps and nullifies in a boring way. And then from halfway through volume 3 onwards, it keeps introducing new plot elements, like lickety split one after another. And then the last two chapters are basically it cutting bait on all the side stories and all the possible like storylines it could use or develop, or the characters it could finish up. And it cuts bait and runs and finishes up in a, admittedly, like, it ties up most of the questions, but all the side stories are left hanging, all the secondary characters are left hanging, and then it ends on a ambiguous "and their adventures go on" ending, which sucks. Because if anything, if you're going to end it, just end it. Just cut it all off. Don't make the ending ambiguous about the main characters and everyone else. Like, it's just a case of, oh, you had a good chance just to end this, and now you've cut everything off, and you've left it really unsatisfying, and it just smells of being undone and unfinished. And there's like a, obviously the translation of the omake says, oh, it was a bit of a rush to get this finished, but I managed it. And it's like, I would say not, lass. So kind of a shame, honestly, because like I say, volume 2 was like, oh shit, we're off to the races. I'm totally bought in on this new development and everything that's going on. And, you know, one last thing about it as well is, when you have God as an actual character and Deus Ex Machina is part of the storyline and a frequent thing you can call upon to help, it seems a bit lame that you then cop out of having a good ending because you have the tool right there. Like, you can press the button. So yeah, it's a shame. It's a massive shame. Like, it introduces quite a lot of interesting stuff, and it kind of just wet noodly flops itself over the line. So real shame, honestly, that one.
Yeah, because, I mean, volume one, it felt like it was kind of setting itself up for a relatively long game. You know, it was clearly not going to be a kind of like 3-4 volume affair. It was probably going to be, you know, sort of 8 volumes at least. It felt like it had set its stall out, or at least started to do that, to the point where it had a pretty big kind of picture plan for what it was going to do. And, like, you know, even if it was maybe going to enter like a holding pattern at some point, it felt like, you know, okay, yeah, this seems like it's going to run for a while. So it definitely sounds like it very much had the rug pulled out from under it pretty spectacularly.
Yeah, it's one of these things where as I say, volumes two and half of volume three start like developing stuff and making it more interesting. And then, as I say, like as it gets towards the end, it introduces more and more stuff in a like pull rabbit out of hat attempt to try and prevent itself from being cancelled. I think like it has the same sort of feeling as a Shonen Jump series that is like, oh crap, we're under the gun. Make it interesting and see if we can get back up the rankings, you know, that sort of behavior, because it keeps introducing stuff and then dropping it just as fast, which is again a shame because it managed to give a lot of glimpses of what could have been if it had time to spread its wings and, you know, work. And as I say, it's a shame because I really enjoyed what was about just over half of it until, as I say, the last volume is basically just a big old, like, you know, it's just a big old bone that you're chewing on. You just realize that you should probably just spit it out. That went nowhere, but you know what I mean. So it went nowhere, kind of. But yeah, that's my two returning champions, honestly. One actively disappointing, the other one just kind of sad. But yeah, how about you, Andy? You've got something on here that I have on my list, but I haven't yet actually caught up and read.
Yeah, so having kind of gushed about it quite a bit on our last podcast, so go back and listen to that if you haven't already, because who skips episodes of a podcast? Jesus.
Me. I listened to like 20. It's my fault.
Yeah, but not this one. This is unskippable. Yes. So yeah, so I went back and checked out volume 2 of Eniali and Dvila, aka the series that we will pronounce differently every time we say the title, most likely. And there's not really too much to say about it. It is broadly more of the same, which is very much a good thing. It is still as great looking as volume one. If anything, it kind of, if there's one thing to be said about it, is that it's kind of everything that we liked about that first volume, it kind of stretches its legs a little bit more in volume two, if anything. Like, visually, it sort of, it tries a few different things and kind of, like, you know, branches out a little bit. Like, narratively, Volume 1 had some moments of this, but I feel like Volume 2 has some really versatile bits of storytelling. Like, there's one kind of two-chapter story that actually, like, you know, it continues across chapters, which is sort of a bit of a kind of eye-opener in itself, because everything else has been pretty kind of compartmentalized into a single chapter. But like, it has sort of a storyline that kind of starts out as pretty typical fare for the series, but then it kind of takes this pretty cool turn into feeling like a sort of a kind of like film noir tribute almost in certain ways, with like its characters and the way they're set up. There's like a kind of femme fatale that kind of gets introduced into things. Then it kind of takes a diversion via a zombie apocalypse, which, like, again, really goes for it with the art style, and it's just, you know, all kind of decomposing flesh and eyes hanging out of sockets, and like it goes all in on that for a little while to really kind of again show its sort of visual chops. And then just as you think that that's maybe gonna kind of outstay its welcome, it kind of like cuts back to its sort of film noir stuff, and then kind of circles right back around to being the more standard fare you'd expect from the series. And it manages to pull all of that stuff off and all of those pivots and turns without ever feeling unnatural and forced, and it really kind of just goes for it. And it's, I was kind of like, got to the end of those two chapters and just like, wow, like that story alone should have dropped the ball so many times, and it kind of like took all of those risks, and it always just managed to pull it off and just feel like it was just still seamlessly moving forward. And then I'm kind of on the other side of that coin, and again a little bit similar to one of the chapters in volume one, like it has a chapter that's actually, it still has a little bit of comedy and a little bit of slapstick to it, but it's actually just a really poignant kind of little side story. Like, it kind of it focuses just on Dvila, kind of like chasing down this particular soul that belongs to an old lady, and it just turns into this really beautiful little kind of picture postcard of a woman who's at the end of her life but is still finding reasons to live. And like, they're really simple reasons. Like, she just like, hey, I just want to enjoy a good meal tomorrow, I just want to sit down and enjoy the sunset. And it's just this really, like, actually, like, not a kind of full-on waterworks thing, but like my eyes were definitely a little bit damp by the end of it, of just like, that was just a really sweet and kind of touching and kind of thoughtful little thing about kind of growing old, and that, you know, it's not kind of this case of like, ah, well, somebody's, you know, they retired, they've had a family, they've done everything, like, they can just kind of shuffle off this mortal coil. Just this idea that, no, like, people still have things to live for when they get older. Like, there may be simpler things, they may be different, they're not gonna go and travel the world necessarily, but, you know, there's still important things to them. And it's just this really sweet little story that kind of, like, sort of closes off a really nice little chapter as well. So yeah, like, very much in the vein of Volume 1, like, highly recommended. If you check out Volume 1 and like it, then absolutely this is well worth picking up. Still visually stunning and still a lot of fun, and with a few little surprises thrown in as well. So yeah, like, really, really loved it as well.
Makes it sound like a BL Metamorphosis crossover manga.
I mean, yeah, there really is kind of a little bit of the same vibe of this kind of, like, old woman, where it's just like, yeah, it definitely hits some of the same notes as that character, just with more, like, weirdness and a devil lady with very good fashion sense.
Yeah, oh good, the fashion game is still on point then, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, again, it just it kind of, like, it continues to go for it and continues to kind of, at times it almost starts to feel a bit self-aware in the second volume at times, where it becomes a bit playful with it, and it's just, like, kind of really goes for it. Like, there's one chapter which, again, is kind of like one of those sort of bombastic, ridiculous moments that this series can have, where, like, Eniali is basically, like, wearing, like, half swimsuit, half tuxedo, and it works, and it's just like, okay, sure, you can just do whatever the heck you like and you're still gonna make it look good, so sure, just go for it.
I'm pretty sure that was in a Bond film at some point. So yeah, also your mention of a femme fatale is kind of scary, given that the main two characters are femme fatales kind of in their own right, so oh god, another character.
yeah so. I mean, that's, yeah, like, you know, she's very much just there for that story, but, like, yeah, it's kind of like a really great little kind of character that doesn't get a lot of kind of panel time, but, like, just kind of eats up every panel she's in, and also just, like, provides a really fantastic, like, denouement for the entire story arc as well, which is like, well worth sticking around for. So yeah, good times.
The Evangelion Kaoru effect, where everyone goes, wait, this guy's only in one episode, what the hell, like, what's going on?
So, yeah, yeah. Quality not quantity.
Yeah it's like, oh, this character's ruined everyone's brains, cool. Okay, that sounds rad. Yeah, as I said, I've got it on my tablet, I haven't read it yet, but all the more excited to do so now, so that sounds cool. And I think volume three comes out soon.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I hope that third and final volume is out pretty soon, because, yeah, I'm like, you know, I can wait for it, but I'm definitely hankering just to kind of enjoy the final installments of these two ethereal idiots.
Yeah, I must admit, like, we had some people saying, oh, I'm glad you tried this, because I was hovering my finger over the buy button, and unsurprisingly we had some people going, oh, you don't like Rich Hat, but you like this, and it's like, yep, we told you, that's why we were shocked during the episode. Now, if only we could kidnap the author and get him to go back to do more of this. although, whatever, let them do what they like, they've clearly earned it. So, yeah, that's great. I'm looking forward to going back to that. And, yeah, so I've got something now to fill the hole left by Batum and Starcrossed. So, hooray. The manga train never stops. Okay, moving on to the main part of this episode of Screen Tone Club. Our main topics. I'm going to take point, and I picked the volume one of the Miki Yoshikawa joint, A Couple of Cuckoos, which is currently being published by Kodansha Comics. It has two volumes out in English, with a third one, I think, next month or this month. It's soon. I know it's soon because I've got it on wishlist. And it's got five volumes in Japan. There's no anime yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was one eventually. It's currently digital only, or digital first, as Kodansha like to say. And so I came to this because of, you may notice that Demel's Award, friend of the show and also Patreon supporter, lives rent-free in my head and said, hey, Elliot, you should read this. And I went, because the reason why I went, and made funny noises is because Miki Yoshikawa, while I have previously liked their work, also drives me up the wall, because I previously read Yamada-kun and the Seven Witches, which is also one of Miki Yoshikawa's works, and I came away really, really angry with it, because it never found a place to end, it dragged out forever, it made the characters garbage through the length, and it did several weird memory wipes and retcons, which really sucked all the joy out of it. And frankly, that series had like two or three points where it could have ended gracefully and been a really nicely sewn up manga, but instead it went for the fences and lasted far too long. long, yada, 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 moan, moan, moan. Anyway, that's my two penneth on Yamada-kun and the Seven Witches, which I think does have an anime now, so you can go ahead and watch that if you want. It used to be on Crunchyroll. I don't know if it still is on Crunchyroll manga. I haven't looked for a while, ever since I stormed away from it. Anyway, A Couple of Cuckoos is another series in the like romantic comedy genre. Principal main character is Nagi Umino, who is a second year student at a prep school, high school student, you know, that sort of thing. He's ranked second in his grade. He's a smart boy. He likes to train. He likes to study, even, not train. That makes him sound like a buff dude. But basically, right at the start, you get the one chapter, one shot version of the story where basically he gets mixed up at birth with another person who you don't know until the end of the first chapter, but it's Erika Amano, who is a blonde-haired, like, Instagram-loving girl who is a daughter of a hotel tycoon, except not, because they were swapped at birth and should have been in each other's different lives. Nagi himself lives with a pair of delinquents who are very endearing sorts, and they run a little izakaya, which looks lovely, frankly. And he lives in a slightly dilapidated flat and studies his nuts off so he can confess to the girl who is taken number one spot in the year, Hiro Segawa, who is the best character in the series and will probably not win the quote-unquote bowl as a result. Also starring in Sachi, who is Nagi's non-biological but familial sister, and Sachi is kind of a sweetie, also keeps appearing in the omake as like a pouty teenager going, hey, when do I turn up in this story? And Nagi and Sachi, I am with you. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked by the characters. So basically, Nagi and Erika meet up by accident. It's been agreed that the two of them will meet. Well, they don't know each other at that point, but each of them are going to see the other child who was swapped at birth. And then it turns out that, oh, it's both of them. Oh, snap. And also Erica's dad, who is basically dad ex machina in this series because he's hilariously rich, hotel tycoon, and constantly just like lays landmines for the pair of them. He's also agreed that, well, if you two get married, then it'll smooth everything over because we'll all be one big family, which seems like a massive, like, weird wet fart of an idea. And basically, it's the families trying to glue these two together so they don't, like, punch each other to death. And also, they get used to each other. You know, Erika sees life through someone who isn't, like, spoilt rich and also helicopter parented to within an inch of her life. And Nagi gets to hang out with someone who isn't just a study bug. And so, yeah. And also at the same time, he's going after Hiro Segawa, who is his crush, who I really like because she has great hair, even though she seems to have the most toxic personality possible because she is hyper competitive about everything. And so, yeah, that's the sort of setup and synopsis. I came down really liking this, mostly because it has the sort of Goonie energy, and as yet it doesn't have too many characters or things to keep track of. Like, there's no supernatural kiss-based teleportation mind swap stuff going on. It's just dumb Goonie crap with daft families and, you know, school life, yada yada, romance as a teenager, and, you know, Nagi himself being quite straight-laced and serious. I kind of found myself liking him because while he's smart, he's also a complete goon. In fact, both of the main characters are complete dumbasses who take leave of common sense quite frequently. And yeah, I came away kind of enjoying it. And there's a reason why, because also I've already picked up volume 2. So kind of already got ahead of you, Andy. So now that I've laid out that and kind of gabbled a bit, but Andy, what did you think of it as the person who is coming to this fresh from volume 1?
It's fine. It's like, it's incredible how much heavy lifting, like, this series does just by having all of its characters be complete idiots. Like, they're all incredibly, like, imbecilic in a way that is kind of, that sort of works, it works better than some other kind of harem comedies where you find yourself constantly like, why are they doing that? What, that's a really dumb thing to do. Because like, every character sort of gets laid out as being incredibly stupid in their own unique way. Like, even Nagi, who's like, oh yeah, like, you know, super smart student, but clearly, like, in terms of actual real world common sense, complete moron. And so, like, the series really kind of gets away with quite a lot just because there's a certain element of believability to everything that happens here, because it's just like, yeah, that seems like what this bunch of idiots would do. And that does carry it quite a lot in terms of just pure sort of entertainment value, of just kind of watching whatever these idiots will do next, because it sort of, it does open it up to less scrutiny than perhaps other series where you're kind of constantly like second guessing how things are going to pan out.
Yeah, totally. I can see that for sure. It definitely gives it like a Teflon coating, where the two of them do dumb shit. Like, you know, Erica goes to Nagi's house and is like, oh, it's tiny. What is this? A shed? And then, you know, they go to, Erica's house and it's huge and he's terrified. And then they end up in like a communal house at the end of volume two, like, you know, Terrence's house or, you know, Big Brother or something. Because as I mentioned, Deus Ex Rich Dad. So that's kind of weird. And as I say, all the characters being kind of dummies and talking past each other, kind of, as you say, gives it a lot of rope. One thing I must admit, going back to this second time, is that everyone seems to have a terminal case of stupid, because right on the very first page, when Nagi's mum / Erica's actual biological mother gives birth, the nurse says, oh, it's a daughter. And then she doesn't think to inquire when she gets a boy back. And it's like, hang on, like, wait, you should have, the genders are different. Like, I mean, I know gender is a rip off, is a crock, but like, you should know that they've been swapped here rather than it being unknown for like 16 years. Like, what's going on?
Definitely that there are questions to be asked. I mean, I feel like there are a multitude of questions to be asked about like the parenting capabilities of everybody in this series, but you know, that is a whole other question. I think that perhaps that the one place where I maybe deviate from you a little bit more is like I kind of found it hard to really attach myself too much to any of the characters, and I kind of feel stupid for even saying it for like a comedy-led series, but I think I was expecting at least a little bit more of an existential crisis from the main two characters, from like having found out that their kind of parents that they'd grown up with weren't their actual biological parents. And I was sort of expecting a little bit of sort of pathos and a little bit of play around kind of the shock and the drama of hearing that. Whereas instead, all you get is Nagi's just like, well, that's great and all, but I need to study. And like Erica's just like, well, that's great and all, but check out this sweet Instagram photo I took. Which, like, I get it. Like, I know people who are kind of like as perhaps self-centered as that they're not going to be worried about some kind of familial crisis because they've got their own stuff going on. But like that kind of made it hard for me to really sort of glom onto either of them, because it feels like the setup is ripe for there to be some kind of like shared trauma or like upset or something about it, and there are little kind of slithers of it that crop up through the series, but like it sort of, given the core concept of the series, like it doesn't really play too much with that in any kind of emotional way. It's pretty much just there as a goof and as a kind of reason for the main two characters being the way that they are. And I feel really stupid saying that I wanted a bit more from that than that, but that was kind of where I came down on that side of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair, wanting to have that explored. I mean, from my point, well, maybe not my point of view, but I think the main thing is that, like, even from the jump from page like two or three, like, it's been some time since they knew about this and they've just set up this first meeting and they don't actually know what the other, their, you know, their swappy is, which is daft. You'd think they'd swap a photo or something given that it's fucking 2020. But as I say, I think the series is so far looking past that and doesn't really care or want to dive into that. I mean, the one element you see about that is Nagi basically going, I don't give a fig. My family that I grew up with is my family. That's all I really care about. It's not, it is a slight element of I just want to study, but it's more the fact that he's like, no, my parents raised me and they are my parents. Like, that's that. I mean, maybe I'm not biologically theirs, but they still raised me and I'm fine with that. And I think, you know, the most you see about this sort of familial sort of existential crisis is Sachi, his sister, who is like, you know, she's kind of very quiet and doesn't really say much even in these first two volumes, but she clearly is like, hey, I it's nice to have my own sister now, but also I don't want to lose my brother because I grew up with him. And it's, she, if anything, she's the one who has the actual existential crisis, but she's barely there because she's a side character.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think quite honestly, like, the series is not interested in that part of the story whatsoever. It's just going to skim past that to the, like, goony comedy romance hijinks. And that's kind of where it wants to live. And so is going to ignore the providence of it entirely.
Yeah, I'm a little bit scared that some of Sachi's behavior is like hinting at a potential future, like, I love my brother in that way, please don't take him away from me kind of thing. Like, there are definitely some moments in there that's like, is this going to be one of those kind of sibling relationship things? Is this going to turn into a thing? Which, yeah, I hope I have that in my notes.
Sorry, Andy. Sorry.
Yeah. So I hope I'm wrong, but it definitely feels like it's kind of tilting in that direction a little bit uncomfortably in places.
Yeah, I hope so as well. I mean, I have in my notes here, oh no, I hope this isn't a not blood related thing. Argh. Fun fact about my look behind the curtain. I use the voice notes feature on my phone to take notes, and there's lots of hilarious typos, but I even captured my yelling and going, argh. So good job, Android. But yeah, I must admit that is kind of a big worrying part of it, is please don't do that. I mean, like, Sachi, if anything, is the one taking the whole, like, swapped brother thing the hardest. But as I say, if they use that as an excuse to be like, no, you're mine. And it's like, oh, fuck off. Like,
yeah. Now you're not blood related. ...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I went to VN like this. Weird. I mean, yeah, also, like, I've already mentioned, like, I really like Hiro Sagawa, the, like, number one girl of the year, the hyper-competitive girl, who also has, like, the one breast size of this series, which is big, but not obscene. So, you know, character likes to draw his boobs. The author likes to draw his boobs, even. And it ends with her dropping a bombshell on the main character at the end of it. And that kind of comes back, unsurprisingly, in Volume 2 and further on, where main character kind of isn't listening to her several times, which is getting kind of annoying, mostly because, like, he would learn a lot if he just listened to what she was saying. But yeah, I really like her, even though she seems destined to be, like, the best girl who gets left behind at some point. And maybe I'm wrong. I kind of hope so, because I like her a lot. So yeah, we'll see. But who knows? I mean, it's kept, thankfully, the one thing it's done compared to Yamada-kun is it's kept the character set a bit tight. Whereas Yamada-kun kind of, it had character inflation a go-go and ended up with half the cast just becoming comedy relief and sapped any kind of, like, interest in them.
Yeah.
I know I keep referring it to Yamada-kun, but it does worry me because I really, really, really wanted to like that series and ended up getting super annoyed with it. And I am enjoying this. Like, it's not exactly like, you know, it's not going to be the sort of thing that I'd yell from the high heavens about, but it was a really enjoyable goony goof. So I was really happy to read this, the two volumes that are out.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems pretty solid. And I don't think we've mentioned it has good faces yet. Like, I feel like that's kind of like, it's almost at the point where it's more of a noteworthy thing if a comedy manga doesn't have good faces, but this still has some good faces.
One funny thing, at least for myself, when it comes to the faces, is whenever the author draws them in profile, they look super weird, and I don't know what is up. Like, I'm not an artist myself, but every time he draws them in profile, they look strange. It's like they turned into Paper Mario characters or something. It's just something, like, it's like they've been cut in half. I don't know. There's something weird about whenever the author draws them in profile. It doesn't look natural. Probably because it is, like, directly, like, half on, like, side on, rather than, like, at an angle, so it makes them look flat. I don't quite know how to explain it, but every single time it looks weird. But yeah, there's lots of good faces, there's good misunderstandings, there's good accidents, there's a really good part where they, you know, the characters just get, like, mixed up or fall over themselves. But yeah, it's got some funny moments. It definitely had me, it wasn't like laugh out loud, but it definitely had me chuckling quite a few times, like enough to want to carry on and see it through. So yeah, I've already bought volume 2, so I'm going to keep reading it. Volume 3, as I say, is soon, so I'm probably going to carry on, even though it is, like, on the more expensive Enakadansha's series. I'm buying it on Kobo where it is cheaper, but it's still creeping up there in terms of price. So that was one of the reasons why I wasn't that hot to try it initially, but eventually my defenses were worn down and I picked it up. So there's that. But how about you, Andy? Are you going to continue with it, or are you just kind of okay?
No, I mean, it's probably one of those things, like, if it was on kind of a reasonably deep cut sale, I might be tempted to read more of it as a kind of lighthearted bit of entertainment. But yeah, I think it was just... always the fundamental thing with this kind of series is you need at least one character to kind of glom onto, either as somebody to cheerlead or be like have your quote unquote best girl who you want to win. And like I didn't come away from this first volume with either of those. I kind of came away with just being like, it's kind of fine, like whoever ends up with whoever, like, you know, just knock yourselves out. As long as you don't end up with your own sister Nagi, then it's all good.
Harem end. Yeah, I must admit, like, it sounds really stupid, but I've said several times, but I really found myself liking Hiro, the other female main character. But at the same time, I can look at her and go, yeah, she's probably not winning because I know how these things are written. And if I'm wrong, hooray. So that'd be nice. So that's always nice to wait for. But yeah, I feel like I've kind of unsold myself slightly on it. I came away initially quite burning hot, but going back to it a second time kind of exposed a few weird flaws to it. But it's still a good read. I still found myself chuckling. So I'm just hoping it kind of pulls itself together better than Yamada-kun. So fingers crossed. This will probably turn up on Returning Champions before long. So look forward to hearing me yet more about this in the future.
Yeah, and that's always kind of the key to this kind of series, is when you get a few volumes in, like, does it just keep expanding out the cast to the nth degree, to the point where it kind of collapses under its own weight? Does it find enough kind of good things to do with the cast it does have, if it doesn't do that, to kind of keep things interesting? And I think that's also, like, partly some of my skepticism is, like, so many kind of, like, sort of romantic comedies of this bent of recent years have just really not done it for me in some shape or form, like, for one of a variety of reasons. And so, like, you know, maybe if this turns out to be a really tight and kind of well-crafted thing as it sort of goes through the motions, then it might well kind of turn me back around on, like, you know, reading it for the long game. But I've been burned too many times.
That's fair. That's more than fair. I mean, I'll let you know how it goes. And as I say, like, it's Kodansha, and they quite often have sales-themed dubiously over one thing or another, and Yamada-kun is constantly on sale, so I wouldn't be surprised if this popped up on sale at some point. And it is ongoing in Japan, so God knows how long it'll be, but hopefully it doesn't go into like the 20s again. So yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I found myself liking it, but yeah, with all the caveats previously mentioned. But yeah, it looks, as I say, apart from the whole face profile thing, it looks nice. It has the one thing I must admit, actually, thinking about it, is I would really like a side story or a series just about the delinquent parents, because they seem like a hoot. It's like a pair of former delinquents who own an izakaya and are generally very active whenever they're in panel. That sounds fun. Like, give me those two.
yeah. Even just like a flashback kind of origin story to how they kind of met, and, like, you know, their you know, unkempt youth would probably be well worth a read.
Yeah, the Elliot Page demand to have more delinquent and Sukeban manga continues unabated yet once again. Just give me the lovable delinquents, please. So yeah, that's a couple of cuckoos. As I say, found myself enjoying it. We'll see how it goes from here. Okay, so Andy, how about your pick? I finished this up just last night after falling asleep on my tablet twice. Whoops. But that's more a me not sleeping problem than a quality of the series problem. Anyway, yes. Go ahead.
Yes, because yeah, it's been a while, but I decided, partly because I had some time off, so I had more time to read stuff, that it was light novel time. Tis time for torture, one might say, to reference another classic series of this podcast. But my pick for this episode is Other Side Picnic, Volume 1, which is a series that I picked up basically off the back of the anime adaptation that's currently airing, which sort of mostly fascinated me, but also frustrated me a little bit in certain ways. But in a way that kind of made me feel like there are some gaps here. I wonder if, like, the source material kind of fills in those gaps in a satisfying way. I have to know. And so that is the main reason why I picked it. It's available on the J-Novel Club. There are 6 volumes in Japan currently, 4 in English, I believe. It's available on Bookwalker, Kindle, etc., as well as J-Novel Club service. It is the story. It kind of starts in medias res with a 25-year-old university student called Soro Kamikoshi, who is kind of in a bad place when we join her. She's basically about to drown. She's in some kind of weird world with weird creatures, and, you know, she's kind of there on her own, and she's pretty much kind of at that point of just like, well, my strength's given out, I'm basically done here, like this is a bad time. But she ends up being saved by a blonde girl of a similar age called Toriko Nishina, and the two of them kind of end up sort of becoming fast friends, with some big quotation marks around the friend side of things, particularly initially.
A question mark and an exclamation mark, and maybe even quotes. Charitable.
Yeah, there is. And one of the interesting things about this volume is kind of like their relationship as it goes through this volume. But basically, once we start to kind of get a better grip of what's going on here, effectively, both of these girls live in normal Japan, but there are all of these weird kind of portals to this other side, this sort of other dimension that is mostly deserted, but there are all kinds of weird glitches and creatures and strange things that kind of roam the land. For Sorrow's part, she just kind of ended up going there because she was a bit into sort of urban exploration and is kind of like ended up being sort of interested in a whole bunch of urban myths and stuff, and ended up finding her way to this other side, which she sort of treats as sort of a bit of an escape from reality, basically. You know, she's a bit of a loner. She doesn't maybe kind of get on so well in the real world, so this was just kind of a nice sort of palate cleanser for her, until it all went horribly wrong, of course. Whereas on Toriko's part, she's basically looking for her friend Satsuki, who has gone missing, assumably in this other side, and so she's trying to kind of figure out where her friend has gone, and to try to kind of find and rescue her. And the interesting thing about this series is that rather than being kind of a fully sort of contiguous story of like kind of like revealing more about this other side, etc., it's very episodic. Like it basically treats each chapter as like a case file, effectively, which sort of gives it a feel. I mean my default kind of like elevator pitch for this is that it's like somebody watched like half a dozen different Doctor Who episodes and has also watched a bunch of X-Files and has just kind of like mashed all of that stuff together into a single series. Because like every episode kind of, there is sort of an ongoing through line, but every episode sort of has its own individual story. It has its own kind of monster of the week, if you like, that it kind of, the two main characters and usually some others that they run into have to deal with. And it just kind of runs with that idea. Like it doesn't feel the need to really dig into the big questions about what is this other side? Like, where did it come from? Like, what is its origins? Like, all of those are kind of things that are sort of floating very much in the background. This kind of series and its characters are far more just interested in the here and now of just like, ha, here's this weird place. Like, you know, we're going to explore it. You know, we're looking for Satsuki, etc. And I kind of really like it for that. I mean, I think one of the smartest things that this series does is that all of the weird kind of like creatures and stories that it pulls together, they feel like they are kind of real urban myths and kind of stories that people have like passed down through internet message boards, etc. And the reason they feel that way is because they are. Like, if you go into the back of this book, the author basically runs off a whole bunch of references and citations for kind of where he cribbed the original ideas for these various kind of sort of like, you know, almost mini horror stories and these sort of, you know, creepy tales that have sort of, you know, been passed into kind of modern folklore. And I think that really lends something to it, because this doesn't feel like an author trying to make scary stories. This does feel like a sort of a collection of weird goings on that have all sort of coalesced into this weird sort of alternate dimension. And that to me kind of gives it a certain power and a certain kind of vibe that I'm not sure that you could get otherwise. And I kind of really appreciate it for that. And the other thing that I kind of liked about this volume is it feels like you're getting a lot of bang for your buck. Like, this was a volume that it felt, I was kind of like surprised how long it took me to read it, and it felt like I'd really like consumed a lot of story, like out of the kind of couple of hundred pages of this book, like, and not in a way where it just feels like it's padding and it's overly dense. It's just, there is something to it where it just feels very full and very fleshed out in kind of everything that happens. Like every chapter is busy. Like it's not kind of, there's not a lot of fluff. And even when there is just kind of like downtime for the characters, it always kind of feels quite important. Like it's always sort of developing those relationships. It's always kind of, it's always finding things to do or to say, or to kind of like shift the goalposts between them, in ways that are kind of interesting, or introducing, you know, additional characters or so on and so forth. And so I kind of came away from this feeling like I'd sort of almost read two or three volumes of another light novel, but actually I'd only read one, which was kind of weirdly satisfying. It was kind of like it felt like I'd had a very good meal for very cheap, basically.
Yeah, I can see that. Man, I want to comment on a whole heap of stuff you just said. I mean, the first thing I'll say about the length is when I first loaded it, it was in tiny print, and I thought, oh, it's 120 pages. That's on the short side, I guess. And then, as you say, it's, I'm not going to say that. But I must admit, like, it's always on. Like, there's no in-between stuff. There's, as you say, it's like Case Files, although it's sequential and it's directed. It's very much a case of, it's in medias res, but it doesn't ever do the backfill fully. It just has, Sororo explain where she was, and that's it. It doesn't go back and do the long, like, backstory and the long flashback. It's just, no, here's why I was there. Here's my history with this other side that I walked into. Oh God. And then it goes from there. And, you know, it kind of, even in the first Case File, it kind of gets a lot of stuff done. Like, it does an entire volume's worth of lifting, because when it ends, like, the characters have shifted, they've made a relationship together, they've introduced to other characters, and it's all kind of moving. So even that first chapter is like a volume's worth of actual content and plot points. It's got a decent pace to it. Like, it's all the sort of filler, all the killer elements and the filler bits, there's the phrase I didn't want to say, but what I mean by that is it doesn't do the annoying light novel two-step. Like, it doesn't have someone do something and then backfill explaining it, or say something, explain it, think about something, explain it. It's all very active and forward. Like, it's like, okay, no, we're going here. Here is a thing here. Here is this. Oh, here's what this is. Hey, what do you think this is? Oh, let's talk about it. Oh, here is the nature. I mean, you mentioned it isn't too interested in the nature of the place, but it kind of directly answers that in the last story of this volume, which is pretty wild. I mean, it could just be the characters like tossing off explanations or theories, but it's really wild where it basically says, I think it's this. And it's like, actually, this kind of rings true. Like, it's not just like a theory, like the characters have kind of come to a pretty solid conclusion here based on what they've seen and done and what's happened to them, and the nature of the place as it stands. And as a result, it's kind of wild because, as you say, like, it is a very dense volume, because it's all forward momentum, it's all developmental, it's all moving forward. Like, even the characters talking amongst each other, like, it's not just them expositing back and forth, it's them talking about the things that are in front of them. So it saves the whole problem, again, the two-step of thing happened, people discuss the thing that happened, no one really develops it. It's more the fact that, like, thing happens, they discuss the developments, what they're going to do now, etc., etc. The only thing about all this development that it kind of sucks, at least for me, I don't like at all, is when you get to the fourth and final sort of chapter in Case File, there is a point when, up on a hill, Sororo basically sees a bunch of landmarks and, like, knits the whole world together, and it kind of sucks, at least for me. It sucks the fun out of it being this, like, spatially inconsistent place where they're going from A to B, but God knows what's there, and are they actually at Z? Who knows? But instead, at the end of, in this last chapter, she goes up a hill and says, oh, there's thing from chapter one, there's thing from chapter three, there's thing from chapter two. And I'm like, what? No, don't do that. Like, that makes the world suddenly seem extremely small. And it went from being this very chaotic, unknowable thing to, oh no, I figured it out. And it's like, that's annoying. Like, you've already made it seem cool because the entrances and exits to this other side are multivarious and confusing and, like, sometimes accidental or incidental. And then it gets tied together like a world map. It's like, oh, this, to use a rather dumb comparison, it's like you're playing Dark Souls and then someone just gives you the wiki map and you're like, no, don't do that. Like, I don't want it. Like, you've made this a lot more boring suddenly.
Yeah,
I don't know if you felt that.
Yeah, it's certainly that is kind of a weird moment in the series. And yeah, because my sort of imagining of it was almost to a certain extent that it's almost a sort of, you know, to continue the video game comparisons, it's almost more of a sort of, you know, roguelike, like, hey, every time you go into this world, it's going to be different. You can't just draw a map on this thing. And it's like, you know, one of the previous chapters to that, you know, there's a whole kind of, like, you know, military involvement where they've stumbled into this world, and it kind of, like, minimizing it like that makes me feel like, well, surely, like, you know, people, this military kind of platoon could have figured out a way out of this, because it feels like it's all easily kind of mappable, and, you know, you could just be very organized about searching for exits, whereas before that point it does, yeah, like you say, it feels chaotic of this kind of, like, okay, there are entry and exit points, but everything else in between is just this kind of, like, unknowable, ever shifting mass, and it does feel strange that it almost constrains itself by that.
Totally. I mean, the third chapter one with the military unit was really weird. I got really picky about that for some reason. They do really bad security with this pair of characters they can't trust, and then, like, I'm gonna sound like a fucking dork, but, like, they just find a gun lying around, and it's like, I mean, even, like, no, like, unless they're really off-piste, people, the military don't just leave guns lying around. Like, you don't do that. Like, you can't. Like, that's a good way for someone to pick up a gun and start going to town on your own troops. Like, you don't leave guns lying around. So.
Yeah, I mean, that I could maybe excuse, because they are in a pretty, pretty bad place. But yeah, generally speaking, like, they are weirdly, like, disorganized. It's like, you know, again, there's a pivotal plot point where they, rather than actually take steps to stop the two girls from doing the thing that you should not do, they just kind of tell them politely, probably shouldn't do that. And it's just like, no, you should maybe have been a little bit more, either a bit more forthcoming or a bit more direct in stopping them doing the thing that was going to make everything go bad, rather than just being a very polite kind of, like, oh, could you please not? Which, I mean, also, like, also a moment where, like, Sorrow and Toriko are kind of jerks, because it's just like they're told specifically not to do a thing with a pretty obvious kind of intimation that there's something bad is going to happen if they do it, and then that's the first thing that they do. It's like a kind of don't push the big red button kind of moment, where it's like, ah, oh, we should push the big red button. It's like, well, no you shouldn't, but okay.
Yeah, and that kind of bedevils them for that rest of that chapter and the next one, where it's like, oh no, okay, what about this? And they get into hella deep levels of confusion about it. Mobile phones in particular in this series get a rough ride. Like, their screens are constantly thrown into, like, strange states, or communication is strange. And at some point you think, like, just don't, I mean, I think Toriko does it at one point where she just doesn't bring it with her. Like, just don't do that. You don't know how electronics are going to work in this world. But yeah, as you say, like, the one thing I will say is something sort of snuck in at the start is that Sorrowo herself is in university for cultural anthropology. And so all this stuff kind of gets into a wheelhouse, especially some of the more sort of mythical elements of it. Like, you say that there is, I mean, well, there is, like, there is the works referenced section, and my second note total says, oh, I love a story with a bibliography, like, unironically. And as you say, like, it comes from, like, message board posts and sort of found lore and communally dreamt up lore, like, as if it was on X or something. But it reminds me, I mean, I don't want to draw a direct comparison because I might get it wrong, but it reminds me of SCP Foundation, which has been a well that's been, like, dumped into and also mined quite a lot previously for horror or scary creepypasta style stuff. But it reminds me of that sort of communally generated, like, spooky stories that, like, tingle the back of your head, and the ones that are more interesting and more sort of taught kind of rise to the top. And from looking at the threads that the original author kind of pulled on for this, it makes sense that it's that sort of thing where it's a communal sort of, like, like cream or most common thing rises to the top out of it, and the more sort of mundane kind of gets saged into oblivion.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
as you say, it works in that regard, because it isn't the author having to come up with stuff whole cloth. It is a case of like, well, I like this, and if I do this, this, and this to it, and I drop these characters into it, this will likely happen. And it makes it a lot more fully formed and fleshed out, like there's a world already there to dump them into, you know, the aforementioned other side.
Yeah. I mean, that was going to be the other kind of like video game reference that I was going to mention is Control, which also like leans very heavily on the whole kind of like SCP kind of lore idea for its narrative. And like, again, there is a bit of a feel of that as well, of these kind of like, you know, whether it's mundane things that are actually like anything but, if they're kind of, you know, interrogated in a particular way, or yeah, just the more kind of general creepiness, like there's definitely a feel of that as well, which is I don't know, it's kind of interesting, because, you know, I'm not really a horror guy, and, you know, I'm not really normally interested in that kind of stuff, but like, this is the kind of presentation that, you know, I find that stuff more interesting, where it's kind of like, there's not really much in the way of kind of outright horror here. Like, it has its moments, but it's more just that general feeling of things being unsettling, which I think actually kind of works better for me. Like, I find that far more interesting and kind of like, you know, more easy to engage with than just outright kind of like, you know, blood, gore, scary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of works in a vaguely Lovecraftian sense, except without the like undeniable racism. So kind of works a bit better in 2020 rather than, as I say, Lovecraft, where it's like, the Asians and fish men, and it's like, okay, dude, yes, we get it, like, shut up. So, you know, that sort of thing. But it, as I say, it does feed upon the communal aspect and the characters, like, especially because Sorowo, as mentioned, like, is a cultural anthropologist and like has some history of being a bit of a downer, and kind of like can kind of intuit all this sort of stuff, whereas Toriko kind of like glides over the top of it for her own sake, which is probably smart. The one thing I will say that's really wild is that the fourth story, the last one, and also possibly the largest one, does a really wild thing where Toriko is kind of taken out of commission and they're trying to find her, and it brings along a third character, Kozakura, who is kind of up till then being their sort of handler, or like, you know, financier in a weird way, their bounty board, who is also hilariously short and ends up kind of just getting dragged through the mud. And that's kind of interesting as well, because it gives a different character for Sorowo to bounce off of. And like, she is really brisk and rude, frankly, but it's really wild where like Sorowo in a weird moment basically just blurts out her entire backstory to Kozakura, and Kozakura basically looks at her and goes, what the fuck is up with you? And it's kind of fascinating as well, because, you know, Sorowo in particular at one point says, oh, I thought this was normal. And it's like, no, you weirdo, your life is fucked up. You're allowed to feel weird, you know, you're allowed to feel bad. Like, you can lean on people. And it's really funny having this like almost misanthropic shorty get pissed off at her. And, you know, kind of, it kind of helps as well, because when Toriko and Sorowo meet up again, it feels like they've both like weirdly learned and sort of had to lean on each other at least once in this volume, and it's kind of forged their working relationship, as well as Sorrow's unending thirst for her, which thankfully doesn't, it never devolves into the whole like paragraph long discussion of her butt, but it does kind of permeate everything, is, oh, you're really hot for her and you're extremely jealous of Satsuki, although you can't voice it and you hate yourself and your self-esteem is like rock bottom, and maybe you'll learn to deal with that at some point, but for now let's focus on getting out alive.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the sort of genre description for this like involves the word Yuri, and like when I first saw that, I'm like, is it though? And then having read this first one, it's like, yeah, okay, it is. But I do really like the relationships between kind of those main three characters, if you include Kozakura as well, and like how they develop. Like, because I mean, Sorowo's kind of starting point is just like basically, please leave me alone, but kind of finds herself being sort of pulled into Toriko's orbit through sort of sheer force of will and guns. Like, guns feature really heavily. Like, why do all these girls have guns anyway?
Well, there is a bit of backstory explanation for Toriko, at least.
Yes, yeah. I mean that feels a little bit dashed off, but yeah, it's just like, oh yeah, like, my parents taught me how to shoot things. This all makes sense. But, like, I do like the way those kind of relationships progress, because, like, it's... There is a really good feeling between kind of Soro and Toriko in particular, of just that kind of, you know, two people who've been thrown together kind of like find that they actually sort of get on okay and have a decent rapport. But there's still like, I really like the way that this series also, it doesn't just go from kind of like, you know, 0 to 100 of just like, yeah, okay, they're just like in perfect harmony, they get on great, everything's wonderful. Like, there's very obvious friction, like you say, the whole jealousy around Satsuki, but there's also just moments where, like, the two characters sort of complement each other, but at times the fact that they are kind of very different in their outlook kind of, like, rubs one or both of them up the wrong way against one another. It's like, Soro can be kind of a bit of a spoiled brat sometimes if she's not getting her way. Like, Toriko is just like constantly going off doing her own thing, even if it's like, you know, not for the best. And I kind of like those interactions between those two when they're actually like not kind of firing on all cylinders and they're sort of, you know, coming into conflict. All feels pretty well kind of written. Like, they feel like a pair of believable characters that, you know, just sometimes, you know, even your best friend sometimes can really get on your nerves, and it just like has those really good moments of just those kind of bits of friction that kind of add a little bit extra kind of frisson to things.
Yeah, the friction in particular, and also like the times that communications break down feel extremely believable. Maybe not realistic, but because it involves a fantastical other side and death-defying survival. But it's more the fact that like when they have misunderstandings, it's a real misunderstanding rather than like, yeah, I fell over. It is more a case of like, no, I'm trying to tell you this. Like, you suggesting that maybe I want more money is not the solution to this problem and my concern. My concern is, oh, no, we've already fallen out and you've fucked off. Shit. Like, it works really well, actually, for setting up quite a few of the stories. Is just, like, the two of them kind of slip past each other in discussions and, like, get het up, or, like, both of them kind of fall into their own funks at times. And it definitely leads to, and especially because a large part of this series and the stories it tells within do deal with differing perception. And, you know, like at the end of this first chapter, like whatever, this is seen on the cover and also is really obvious from the start, but basically Toriko ends up with basically like a truth seeing eye, like permanently warped by the other side, and Toriko ends up with a hand which is partially translucent but can interact with the other world. And so they've now ended up permanently warped by the other side, but also like they have these weird abilities that both like what they can see and also what reality is and also what the meaning is behind that all shift and change and are not quite what it seems. And so, you know, especially with Toriko, who is not the best at expressing herself, it becomes a complete nightmare, because she just can't really explain stuff that well at times. So, but in the more sort of like pedestrian, like just interhuman, interpersonal interaction is not her strong suit. And, you know, it kind of, that's why I kind of enjoy Kozakura so much, because she doesn't give a fig and is like, wow, you're a bit callous, aren't you? You waited 5 days to phone me instead of the other one. And it's like, oh God, this is a nightmare. Like, all these three are going to like just talk shit. And also they're all like young university students. So they, you know, they're out of compulsory education. They're not completely in the same high school garbage. Like, they're not thrown together constantly. They are people who meet up on the semi-regular, kind of infrequently. And that's the one thing that also, again, helps with the pacing, is that they're not having to constantly interact in the in-between states. So you miss out on stuff. It is a case of like, oh, this is actually the next time we met up and talked about this stuff, is this next chapter. So you haven't lost anything, you haven't missed anything, and off we go. Here's another crazy adventure. Here's a dude with an AK-47.
Yeah.
An AK-74, I think.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's an AK-100. Never mind, sorry. I had to look on Wikipedia after reading this.
Oh, God. But yeah, like, it's not a persona where it's just like, hey, we have to go and, you know, go to this other world after school. And it's like, well, you know, I need to study, or I need to chat up Chie. And it's like, you know, it's yeah, there's it's such a small part of the whole, but just like having that feel where it's not always just like, oh, we're going to do this after school, and yeah, like you say, these characters not being in one another's orbit constantly, but having to, especially on Toriko's part initially, like she has to seek out Sorrow and be like, hey, do you want to come hang out in this crazy world? And you know, that sort of just lends a little bit extra to it, I think, as well.
Yeah, totally, it really does. Especially because like at more than one time, Sorrow's like, no, fuck off. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. but yeah, it works. And you can see, I mean, it feels like this one volume, if you wanted to leave it there at the end of this first volume, you could. Like, it feels self-contained, especially with the last chapter. But it continues on for a few more volumes. And I might dip in for another one. I mean, as you say, it felt very substantial. So it was kind of nice in that regard where, like, although I love it, like, Konosuba, you'll read it and you'll burn through it in no time because quite a lot of it is fluff and or the light novel two-step or is just kind of, like, I'm not going to say filler, but it's just very, very fluffy and inconsequential. So you can burn through it in no time whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I'm kind of... If it wasn't a light novel and it's kind of like time constraints, I would definitely be kind of jumping straight in and reading some more volumes, I think, because I do enjoy a lot of what it's doing. And I mean, it's sort of weird because, like, having mentioned at the start of this, like, the anime adaptation felt like kind of something was missing from it. Like, fundamentally and substantially, there isn't. Like, the stories are basically the same. Like, a chapter of this is kind of an episode of the anime, but I think it's almost a weird kind of opposite problem where an episode of anime isn't really enough to do justice to some of these stories, and so it kind of feels a bit sort of dashed together, whereas there's something about kind of the way this is written and kind of laid out, and I think it is actually a well-written light novel, you know, as these things go, like that gives it a bit more substance and just gives it that extra little bit of breathing room to flesh it out that makes the difference between, like, oh, you know, here's a kind of cool idea, bish bosh, it's done, and something that just has a little bit more substance to it.
Yeah, I gotta admit, actually, the writing at the start of the volume felt extremely clunky to me. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it just felt really kind of like having a hard time getting moving, especially when it jumps you in, as you say, like right in the middle of something, and Sorrow's life is in danger. She can't quite comprehend what's happening to her, and it kind of just fumbles around for the first like 20 pages or so, but then eventually kind of gets on its feet, and by that point the characters had captured me and I'd kind of already like tuned into its wavelength and gotten used to it. So yeah, it was just kind of, the start was a bit of a harsh run-up where I'm like, this feels clunky. I can't tell if it's a translation or the source text, but man, this is a bit sort of laborious, at least as I say at the start. So just did take a little while to get going.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's always kind of like a hard thing to write well when you have that kind of, you know, just you're not starting at the beginning of a story of a first volume. Like, it's actually quite a big ask. And yeah, it maybe doesn't quite nail that. But I think, yeah, it pretty quickly kind of gets into the swing of things. And from that point forth, it's certainly like it was a decent page turner. Like, it's, you know, and it's also nice just having a chapter end being a jumping off point as well. Like, it sort of made it quite an easy reading experience of just like, okay, I finished this chapter now, like I can actually safely put this down and kind of come back tomorrow or whenever, because it's not kind of leaving me on a cliffhanger every time.
Yeah, it had really good sort of breakpoints in it, like the little tales and chapters and sections. So it's like, okay, this is a good breakpoint, I'm gonna go do something else. Yeah. The one thing I will say actually about it being a light novel is I think there's like a grand total of two pictures inside it, which is kind of wild because there's quite a few elements where I thought, oh, this would be nice with a picture. Oh, no, there's only like two actual pictures and then the cover. And that's kind of all the art that's in this light novel.
Yeah.
Which felt wild of like, oh, there's quite a lot of stuff I'd like to see illustrated, but I guess not. Oh well.
Yeah, and it almost feels deliberate at times as well, that when it does illustrate things, I think there's only one where I saw where they actually go in and kind of like illustrate one of the weird sort of, you know, glitches or otherworldly things going on. Like, for the most part, it feels like it's almost deliberately avoiding that, because it's like, well, you know, if I try and picture this, you know, and actually illustrate this sort of weird unknowable thing, it's just going to lose a lot of its power. And I think the one time it does it, it actually kind of does that. It's kind of like, I'd actually rather you just left that to my imagination, which again I think is maybe something that, you know, the anime maybe struggles with, because it's a lot easier to describe something that is sort of weird and kind of like, you know, just leave it to your imagination exactly what this strange thing looks like, because as we've mentioned, it's all a matter of perception, etc., etc. Whereas, you know, in any kind of visual medium, like, well, I'm gonna have to draw this now, and thus, you know, the limitation is, you know, what I can draw, and it may be, you know, it doesn't have quite the same impact as a result.
Well, you're also kind of limiting the possibility space of the reader's perception of it as well, which is, you know, one of the things that's very important is to let people's imaginations run wild, because they can think up more interesting stuff than just limiting them to a single interpretation, which is what you do when you put pen to paper. It is one thing, actually, I'll say about the series in particular, is that its description of the, like, I wouldn't say supernatural, but the otherworldly things and the glitches and everything else, both the more concrete and more conceptual elements, it does well at describing them, but also eliding things to let your imagination run with it. But also, it doesn't just fall into, again, apologies, mention of Lovecraft, but it doesn't fall into the Lovecraft like crutch of, oh, it's unknowable, oh, you should look at it and go mad, the cyclopean ruins and the unnatural shapes, and oh, all the angles are wrong. It's more just a fact of like, oh, this is fucked up for these reasons, and I can't quite comprehend what this is, and there's a gap here, and it's like, oh, this is actually more interesting and more gripping when it comes to describe like the things that are wrong with what their characters are seeing and having to comprehend.
Yeah,
and also it does well at bringing in third party characters. Like, basically, the second chapter basically is ripped entirely off of Stalker, the old, you know, like Roadside Picnic and the game series, where the glitches are just like stuff from Stalker, like they are, and that's fine. You're totally allowed to borrow that. But the guy who they team up with is just a stalker, basically, who's trying to find his wifey. Spoilers, doesn't end well for him, unsurprisingly. You can kind of tell from the start.
But
that is kind of the fun thing, where he introduces into some new elements and also keeps enough mystery that it really helps, and also it brings him in as someone who is clearly experienced but has gone through enough shit that he is now a highly unreliable narrator, and that really helps make him a more interesting character, at least to like pal around with very temporarily.
Yeah. I mean, I think kind of all of the other characters that kind of come into this, you know, temporarily, all kind of have their benefits to them. Like you say, there are some flaws and some holes you can kind of pick in the military platoon that you meet. But even then, like, there's a decent amount there that kind of just like keeps that story moving forward and kind of adds another angle to things.
Yeah, it does make it funny when, you know, a pair of young students can outfox an entire military unit. Whoops. Nippon Banzai and all that, I suppose. But yeah, I did like Kozakura an awful lot. Like, she's kind of like the correct level of prick for me to really enjoy and find funny. Like, she's really acerbic even when she's getting basically just like run through the ringer, which is quite fun. Bless her.
yeah, and it is just generally kind of enjoyable that they do that at such an early point, because like, she's very much set up from the get-go as like, well, I don't get directly involved in this, I'm just here to like research from a distance, and it's like, well, not for long.
Yeah, guess what? I've come to your house and now we're all fucked.
Yeah.
So yeah, but yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. I might continue with volume two if I get a moment, because, you know, it felt like I got to see an awful lot, or I got, you know, a lot was in there, so that was enjoyable. But man, if the anime is adapting one story per episode, that's way too short. I agree with you, because like, you need to let these things breathe, and that's kind of the one benefit of this series, is that it does cut out the fluff, and it means that, you know, it, as I say, it's very dense, so it manages to straddle that line quite well. Came away enjoying it.
Yep, likewise. Yeah, I definitely, like, I'm going to try and make time to read at least one more volume of this, because, I'm definitely on board to kind of enjoy a little bit more of it. Like, it's the kind of thing that's not normally typically in my wheelhouse, but it definitely kind of ticks some boxes, and I think those kind of, like, Doctor Who / X-Files kind of weird stuff boxes are definitely some of the ones that it ticks.
And yeah, it's kind of nice as well, because there is like an objective, but it isn't like, you know, collect the 7 like Triforce pieces or whatever the fuck. It is very open ended, so it doesn't need to constrain itself or have like a grand quest to find the Dark Soul or some garbage. Especially now that, like, at the end of this first volume, you have the characters kind of a bit more solid. So I'll see where it develops from there. But yeah, I kind of found myself quite enjoying it. Although I will admit, this is like a really small nitpick, but I really, really, really wish there was an author's afterword in this, just to kind of like have that little look behind the curtain at how the author put all this together. Like, I really want to know about that. And all it was the bibliography, which was helpful, but not quite exactly what I wanted. But maybe that's me just being needy. So, hey.
Yeah, I mean, especially kind of given, yeah, it's kind of its nature and the fact that this isn't all kind of like cut from the author's own cloth and that it's sort of, you know, ideas are cribbed from elsewhere. It would be interesting to kind of to have that kind of thing. But maybe future volumes will have something like that. Who knows?
Yeah, just knowing or hearing more about how they put all this together would be interesting, but hey, maybe next volume. So yeah, that's anything else you want to mention about this, Andy?
No, I think that is everything.
Cool. Yeah, so yeah, it's a good read. As I say, on J Novel Club ongoing, but also they have ebook versions available wherever you can find ebooks. I think there is the digital physical version as well, if I'm remembering correctly. I'll better stop there before I say something I'm going to regret. So, moving on to what we're talking about next episode. I picked something that initially I was like, well, it's physical only, but I'll suck it up for the podcast. And it turns out maybe not. And it did get released digitally stealthily. At least it appears to be legitimate, which is very confusing. You think there'd be more discussion about it, but whatever. Anyway, I have picked volume one of Doro Hedro by Kyu Hayashida, which I think has an anime. Is it on Amazon, I think?
It's on Netflix.
Damn it. Okay, the other service I don't have. But yeah, I've read this once before years ago now, quite literally, and it's now finished and I'm quite eager to see. Have you read this before, Andy?
No, I've watched the anime adaptation, have not read the manga.
Okay, I'm very curious to see what you think about it then. And also, I'm going back to it after a very long break. So, interested to get back into this. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, so I just kind of like almost randomly apropos of nothing, I kind of realized that there's one sort of relatively big sort of shonen property that I've of recent years that I've not actually read or consumed any of in any form, and that is the Seven Deadly Sins. So I figured that given that it's perhaps a deadly sin not to do so, I've picked volume one of that for our next podcast.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure I own this at least once over from a Humble Bundle. So I'll have to go digging around in my file library to find that before I buy a third or fourth copy of it. So yeah, cool. Okay. I've also known about this, but I've never really been interested to dive in. So this will be interesting to go to it. Okay. Cool. So moving into close down, thank you very much for listening. Wow, we kind of went long on this one, but I think it's worthwhile. If you want to find our website, it's at screentone.club. You can find all our previous episodes there, as well as all the notes and also a list of all the series we have covered, now getting quite long. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend, tweet about it, that sort of good stuff. Word of mouth is still the best way for podcasts to grow. We are going to try doing some advertising at some point soon, I swear. We'll see if that works. If you do want to advertise for us and be a very nice, lovely person, you can put a rating or a review on your podcast service of choice. That stuff, again, really helps with, you know, discoverability. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can, at Screentone Club. Trying to be a bit more active on there. I keep meaning to tweet stuff through there more often. We'll see if I remember to do so. You can also email us if you so wish at show@screentone.club. We have so far received about 2 emails to that, but hey, both of them were good, so that's 100% betting average. Love it. My name, as mentioned, is Elliot Page. You can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter, where I mostly post pictures of my cat once again, and sometimes pictures of little lizard men, Warhammer figures, because I'm a sucker who can't stop buying plastic miniatures. I can't even blame lockdown. It's just me being a moron. Andy, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Hannahs1979, where you can find me posting pictures of penguins with really long legs and other wonders from the worlds of anime screenshots.
Jesus. Okay, that's scary. I don't want to imagine a 6 foot tall penguin. That's just
well, thanks to Heaven's Design Team, now you can.
Oh yeah, I read that volume. That seems fucked up. Don't do that. Oh dear. Man, I should do a Return of Champions on that. Okay. Look forward to that next episode, Andy. Sorry. But yeah, before I drag us out any longer, thank you very much and good night.
Bye everyone.